The art of corruption. Everyone is susceptible to its influence, especially teenagers. The adult mind in its mid to late 20s is set in its ways, but the mind of a teenager is still growing and moldable. Those in positions of authority and power hold the most influence over the minds of children, whether through music, television, or personal interaction. But sometimes corruption comes through more sinister means. In the remote town of Dulfran, Aisha Ali, a local school teacher, was walking home when she came across a group of teenage boys. She'd never seen these boys before, which didn't surprise her, for some of the local children were forced to work to support their families rather than go to school. These boys, however, made inappropriate comments and gestures toward Aisha. Not wanting to cause an issue, Aisha ignored the boys and went about her way. Aisha didn't think much of the boys, aside from the thought of how rude and immature they were being. But when she noticed the boys were following her, she began to get nervous. They made sexual remarks and kept asking her to slow down for a moment, all the while laughing. With each remark and cackle, Aisha hurried her steps. It wasn't until one of the boys grabbed her from behind and cupped her breast that she screamed. Her screams echoed throughout the evening air, followed by laughter. When Aisha's body was discovered the next morning by a local wildlife officer, he reported that a woman was viciously attacked by a pack of wild animals, judging by the pieces of flesh scattered around the body. The body that had its chewed up intestines flowing out of the ripped up abdomen. I'm Agent Kai, and I've decided to make my reports for Lyos in the form of a podcast. My hope is that you, dear listener, will discover the truth of this world and open your eyes to it. I watched as the sun began to set below the Toronto Pearson International Airport's runways. There was something calming about watching sunsets during late autumn. They were more poignant, yet beautiful somehow. Once the sun paid its adieu to the Canadian skies, I returned my attention to my laptop to put the final touches on my latest report concerning the haunting of the Rook family. It was a simple case involving a cursed object. The object in this case was a 500-year-old porcelain doll that Mrs. Rook had acquired for a hefty price at Sotheby's auction while visiting New York City. All things considered, the exorcism involved in getting rid of the malignant spirit haunting the doll was routine. Since nothing of note took place during this mission, dear listener, I deemed it unnecessary to report it in full here. Once I finished my report and emailed it to Cameron, I tucked my laptop into my messenger bag and started for the twist bar. As I made a turn from the lounge area into the main terminal, I bumped into a woman and caused her to drop her luggage. "Oh, damn it," she said. "I'm so sorry, I didn't see..." The woman paused and examined me for a moment. "I'm sorry, have we met before?"
"I don't believe so," I said, picking up the woman's luggage. "I would have remembered you if we had."
"Thank you," the woman smiled. "It's so weird. I think you're right, but I can't help but feel like we've met before somehow. I'm Victoria Lakatos."
She extended her hand. I shook it. "My name is Will Aslan."
Victoria shook her head. "Yeah, no, that name doesn't suit you." She chuckled. "Sorry, I don't mean to stare at you. Just such a weird feeling. Listen, do you maybe want to grab a drink?"
She looked at her phone.
"Shit, never mind. I'm late for my flight. Oh, damn it. Sometimes I wish I wasn't the head flight attendant."
"Perhaps some other time we'll get that drink," I said.
"Yes, for sure," she said, starting toward her gate. "If we bump into each other again, we'll call it fate. We'll have to have that drink then."
"Absolutely," I said, watching Victoria until she vanished into the passenger boarding bridge. In truth, dear listener, I wanted to tell Victoria that we did know each other, that we had been together several times and faced the Grimad, the Mananagal, and Sand, and the reason she didn't remember any of that was because of the MAU. However, it was for the best that she remained in the dark, despite my wanting otherwise. I would be lying if I didn't say a large part of me had been wanting to see her, and bumping into her reminded me of just how much. My phone rang. "Listen, that was a great report, Kai," Cameron said. "And I'm glad things went smoothly. Hopefully, this mission gave you some time to recover from your wounds."
"It did."
"Good," Cameron typed away on his end. "Because we're going to need you now in Somaliland." Cameron went on to say that a Lyle's agent, Agent Locke, was investigating gruesome murders in the remote village of Dulferan. However, according to his handler, Pim, Locke failed to check in at 0800 hours and hadn't been heard from since. Pim, fearing Locke killed by whatever was going on in that remote village, began the paperwork for a deceased agent on the field when she noticed that Locke's phone was active. Elias' agent's phone, dear listener, can only be accessed by the assigned agent for the phone to work. If a person other than that Lyle's agent tries to use the phone will burn itself to ash. Same thing applies to Lyle's agent's assigned laptop. Pim tried to contact Locke several times to no avail. Thinking perhaps Locke was hurt or worse, she spoke to Cameron for advice. According to the Lyle's protocol for agents on the field, if a Lyle's agent is injured or held hostage by any entity and the possibility exists for extraction, then a handler may contact another handler of an agent to be dispatched and extract the agent now deemed a Schrödinger agent. Therefore, Cameron assigned me the double task of investigating the disappearance of Agent Locke and the gruesome murders occurring in Dulferan. Agent Locke was a strong Lyle's agent who began his career in this organization 1 year before me. Locke, it was rumored, was one of Patrice Landless's favorite agents. For, like her, Locke had a penchant for the fancier things in life. It was no secret that Locke enjoyed his Magnum 2.5 champagne, expensive suits, and luxury cars. While Locke's expensive lifestyle was questionable, Landless didn't seem to mind. Perhaps because his lifestyle was similar to hers, again. Either way, the fact Landless allowed Locke to revere in the high-end luxuries of the world was proof that she had deep pockets. Regardless of Locke's expensive taste, the man was good at his job. I knew him for his Feral People assignment in Wrangell St. Elias National Park. Locke infiltrated this Alaskan rainforest in search of missing hikers and found a population of feral humans living in the heart of those woods. These feral humans worshipped a large beast they dubbed the Great One, who told these people to hunt humans and eat them. Locke put an end to that cannibalistic cult, but failed to find the Great One, who Locke believed was a Sasquatch. "Locke's gone missing, huh?" I said. "That's tough to believe."
"I know, Kai," Cameron said. "But Landless wants you on this assignment. She feels you're the only one who can take this on at the moment."
"Is that right?"
"That is a fact," Cameron said. "Also, I spoke to Landless, asked her why she's sending agents out to track Tamamo no Mae. She didn't have a clear answer, and it worried her. Now she, too, believes something is rotten."
"It's good. I believe that Tamamo no Mae targeted several intelligencers to get us to notice her. However, I'm not sure why she's done that. I'm still working on it."
"Same on my end," Cameron said. "I will keep you updated, Kai, and good luck to you in Somaliland. Keep me informed on your end."
Once the call ended, I made my way over to the nearest United attendant desk and switched my ticket from Key West International to Igal International. I had Percy Blade tighten my legend so that now read that Will Aslan was a game ranger from South Africa specializing in poaching and abnormal predatory behavior. It always amazed me how Blade could do such detailed work within the 15 or so hours it took for my flight to arrive in Somaliland. While I drove from the airport in my old rented Toyota 4Runner all the way out to the remote village of Dulferan, I listened to my notes on predatory hunting behavior and poaching basics.
The sun was at its highest point when I pulled up to a pickup truck on the road. I parked behind it, got out, and made my way toward a man who was standing over something on the ground, several feet away from the road on the open land. "Sitahe," I said.
"Oh, you're the game ranger."
"That's right." The man walked up to me.
"Well, I'm glad you're here because I can't figure this out."
We shook hands.
"My name's Cal. I'm the game warden in these parts."
"Will Aslan."
"You got a strong stomach, Will?"
Cal said.
"I hope you do. Follow me."
Cal led me toward the remains of what was once a man. The body was torn asunder, an arm here, a leg over there, the severed head with a cracked skull several feet away from the rest of the main body. The torso was ripped apart, the intestines were chewed open and oozed out of the abdomen. Deep gashes covered every inch of visible flesh, while bone revealed parts of the body where the flesh was picked clean. I crouched down to examine the exposed femur where the thigh had been devoured. The femur revealed gashes and scratches. Something chewed through the flesh of this man and took large chunks of meat in a hurry, judging by the way the bone was all scratched up. "It was big, whatever did this," I said, standing up.
"Yeah, I agree."
Cal walked over to the head.
"And come take a look over here."
Cal showed me the head in more detail, how the skull was crushed. There was a clear fluid leaking out of the ears, cerebral spinal fluid.
"What do you make of this?" Cal said.
"Whatever attacked this man did so from the front." I examined the skull in more detail. The left eye was jammed deep into the socket and the crown crushed in. "It was tall. This creature brought its snout down from the top of the man's head."
Cal nodded.
"I was thinking the same." He paused.
"What the hell is it?"
"I'm not sure." I looked around. There was nothing but open, dry land for miles. Not in many places for such a big animal to hide.
Cal crossed his arms over his chest.
"I'm at a loss. I don't know what could have done this. I can only assume it was a lion or a pack of lions, maybe hyenas."
I nodded.
"Yes, that's possible. Either of those could have knocked the man down and attacked from there. How many deaths did this man make?"
"Two that I know of," Cal said.
"This is a recent kill. A few weeks ago, it was a woman, Aisha Ali, local school teacher, ripped to shreds too."
"Do you know who this man was?"
"Yeah, Bilal Ahmad, farmer from the local village."
"Dhul Faran," I said.
Cal nodded.
"That's right."
His walkie-talkie crackled.
"Police are on the way, boss man."
"Copy,"
Cal said.
"Well, Mr. Will, this has been a hell of a way to meet. Police are on their way to pick up the remains of Bilal.
How about we head into the village after we help here?"
"Sounds good."
The village of Dhul Faran was a crumbling community consisting of shacks barely held together. On the outskirts of town was a farm that had seen better days, and a small school building that held two or three classrooms. The villagers went about their business, fear clearly written on their faces.
"These villagers all want to leave,"
Cal said, as we walked through the village.
"But they have nowhere to go. And now that Aisha's gone, well, people here are heartbroken. She was the glue of this place. Aisha was self-taught. She learned English on her own, went to university on scholarship, and then came back to help educate the children of Dhul Faran."
Cal shook his head.
"Damn shame. The only person who cared about these people, and now..."
"I'm sorry to hear that," I said. "Aisha sounded like a wonderful person."
"She was, man."
Cal paused.
"It's always the good that suffer in this world, isn't it? Aisha, Bilal, they were good, hardworking people."
He cleared his throat. "I'm sorry. With Aisha gone, that only leaves Farah at the school. Poor girl. She's torn apart by all this death."
Cal turned to me. "Listen, do you mind if we go and check on her?"
"Not at all." I followed Cal through a rugged road flanked by open land to the small school building, which was half a mile away from the village. There, a group of teenage boys were gathered under an acacia tree. The boys glanced at us and laughed as we passed by them. The boys whispered amongst themselves.
"Another one."
Farah Alad was seated on a courtyard bench accessible from within the school and by walking around the back of the building. She was reading a copy of The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy when she looked up at us. Her deep brown eyes that had a slight yellow tint to them were solemn.
"Cal, how'd it go?"
Cal rubbed his neck.
"Not well. Bilan is gone."
"Oh no, Bilan." Farah ran a hand through her long, raven hair.
"Maybe the villagers are right. We're being hunted."
"That's not possible," Cal said. "No animal hunts humans like this. There's got to be a good explanation for those losses." Cal turned to me.
"Farah, this is Will Aslan, game ranger from South Africa. He's here to help with catching the animal or animals responsible for these attacks."
Farah looked at me and gave me a wan smile.
"Hello. Do you think this animal or animals are hunting us?"
I wanted to tell Farah that Cal was right. The animals don't hunt humans. However, I'd be lying. You see, dear listener, there are cases where apex predators do hunt humans on purpose. Take, for instance, the Tsavo man-eaters of Kenya that were responsible for well over 20 deaths between March and December of 1898. These pairs of lions consumed construction workers who were building the Kenya-Uganda Railway. The lions were deliberately hunting people, feasting on their flesh. It wasn't until Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson put a stop to these murderous cats that peace resumed.
"I'd like to say no," I said, "but I don't know. I will find out, and once Cal and I know what we're dealing with, we will put a stop to it. I promise you that."
"I hope so, Mr. Aslan," Farah said, rubbing her arms. "Aisha and Bilan, they didn't deserve to die like that."
"No one does."
She gave me a furtive glance. "I hope you do better than the other one."
"The other one," I said.
Farah nodded.
"Yeah, there was another man here, an American, I think, who said he was a game hunter."
She paused and thought for a moment.
"Patterson. Henry Patterson, he said his name was. Claimed he would catch whatever beast was running amok."
"The hell, Farah," Cal said. "When were you going to tell me this?"
Farah shrugged.
"I thought you knew. How long since you last saw this game hunter?"
"A few days now," Farah said. "Last I saw him, he was heading out toward the ruins."
Cal cursed under his breath.
"Come on, Will," Cal said, staring back toward the village. "We have to go check on this man."
"Goodbye, Mr. Aslan," Farah said.
"I do wish you luck, and you too, Cal."
I followed Cal in my Forerunner while I spoke to him via the walkie-talkie he lent me.
"I can't believe Farah didn't tell me about this Patterson man. The hell was she thinking?"
"Perhaps she meant what she said and thought you knew," I said. "Tell me, what are the ruins?"
"A creepy place, let me tell you. The locals in Dulfaran call the ruins the graveyard. They say the dead walk there."
Cal cursed under the walkie-talkie. "Stay close."
After driving on a dirt road for over an hour, we came across the ruins of an ancient city. There wasn't much except for the crumbled remains of stone buildings, towers, and arches. Parked by one of the ruined buildings was a jeep with scratch marks all over the doors and hood. Cal and I studied the jeep with careful eyes.
"I fear the worst has gone down here," Cal said.
"That's a possibility.
Did you notice anything strange at the kill site where we found Bilan?"
I nodded. "There were no tracks other than Bilan's own footsteps."
"That's right. And it seems like the same thing here."
Cal paused. "You don't think this animal's covering their tracks?"
"I never come across such a thing," I said, "but I wouldn't be surprised."
Cal nodded.
"Yeah, same here.
This world we live in now is full of oddities that defy reality. More than we'll ever know."
"All right," Cal said. "We're going to have to split up here to cover more ground. Use the walkie if you come across a body or anything, and be mindful. As much as I don't want to believe silly superstitions, there may be strange things here."
Cal and I split ways. He took the western side while I went straight into the ruins. The graveyard, as the locals called it, was bigger than it appeared, and with the sun beginning to set over the horizon, this place gave off a menacing vibe. Along with the occasional howl of the wind, came voices that seemed to be frozen echoes of the past. Whatever this ruined city was, I thought, it met its fate in a devastating and a violent manner. Embedded into the cracked stones were remnants of blood. Some of it was dried. It had been dried for a long time now, but some of it was fresh. I used the walkie-talkie.
Cal, I found some fresh...
Laughter ricocheted off in the distance. The walkie burst. It cut out. Then...
Surround it!
I started running toward the western side of the ruined city. The closer I got toward Cal's location, the louder the laughter grew. This continued until I found Cal surrounded by the same group of boys we saw back at the school. In unison, the boys jumped on Cal and began tearing the man's flesh with their nails and teeth. Cal screamed as he tried to push the boys off him. They were eating him alive. I pulled out a heliosphere, a small marble-sized disc, and threw it over to the boys. Within seconds, the darkening sky flashed and burned like a star in the darkest night. This was enough to distract and temporarily blind the pack of crazed teenagers, while I unleashed a bottle of silk weavers, tiny mechanized spiders that spit a tightening and unbreakable web. The silk weavers went to work without hesitation, spinning the webs on the boys, five in total, until they were immobilized on the ground. I ran toward Cal, who was still on the ground cursing to high heaven. In the few minutes the ravenous boys had been on top of Cal, they managed to rip off chunks of flesh from the man's arm, thigh, and shoulder. Some of these bites were so deep the bone was exposed. "Cal, hold on," I said. "I'm going to..." The bullet burst through Cal's forehead, silencing the man for eternity. The boys, still tied down to the ground, some still chewing on flesh, broke out in laughter. Agent Locke stepped out from the shadows of twilight. "Kai, what a surprise to find you here," he said, his gun's barrel still smoking. "I'm afraid you're interrupting my boys' meal." "Locke, what the hell are you doing?" "What I should have been doing long ago. What you will be doing soon." As Locke came closer, I could see that something wasn't right with the way he moved and the way he looked. His face was touched up as if with makeup and was stretched in a tight hold. The man's brown eyes were somehow blank, despite their fixed gaze on me. Even the way he held the gun in his hand was off. It looked more like a doll or action figure holding a prop piece. "What happened to you, Locke?" I said.
"Immortality happened," he said, his mouth sagging. "I am now eternal, free to romp around like the mind of God."
Locke started to circle me. His movement was stiff, stop-motion picture-like. "Immortal," I said. "Looks more like you've been turned into an undead wax figure." Locke let out a hoarse laugh.
"This is the price of eternal life."
"Oh, I know that to be true," I said. "A friend of mine once explained it to me. It doesn't sound comfortable. But what are you doing here, Locke? You were supposed to help the people, not continue to cause harm." Locke coughed, expelling sand.
"I am finally seeing what this world is about. Don't you, Kai? Can't you see it? Being an agent for some clandestine agency, whose director may or may not exist, running around the world and keeping the truth from getting out of control, and running the greatest chance of death? What kind of life is that?"
Locke paused. "The fate of all Lyle's agents is a lonely and unremarkable death."
"Yes, that was stated to us during our training. We all accepted that truth."
"We're just puppets, Kai," Locke said. "Landless doesn't care what happens to us."
"Hell, I've never even met the bitch."
"She's worried about you, Locke," I said, "and so is Pym."
"Is that right?
Well, what does it matter?"
"You're right," I said. "It doesn't matter anymore. You're clearly dead. Just rotting flesh playing off memories of a misfiring brain."
"She said you wouldn't understand." Locke raised the gun toward me.
"Well, understand it or not, our queen will grant you eternal life."
I chuckled.
"By stuffing me with sand and playing puppeteer. I don't think that suits me."
You don't have a choice, I'm afraid.
Queen.
To Mama no Me, I said.
Of course,
Locke said, his sagging face contorting into a haunting smile. She's beautiful, and I'm glad I'm now serving her. You will be too.
Locke let his face sag once more.
She's fond of you.
Where is she?
Then, now, there, Locke said. She's the truth of this world.
She's playing us, I said.
Tamamo no Me doesn't care about you, me, or anyone, but she goes out of her way to make us all think of her. Then, now, there. Her presence is felt everywhere.
Oh, she's clever.
What are you mumbling about?
It all makes sense now, I said. She rules man's globe. She is a goddess.
But of course, Locke said. The only goddess.
She needs worshippers, I said. And wants all of us to worship her, even without our knowing.
Talku was right. Our paths may have to cross again.
Enough, Kai. Locke cocked the gun. Goodbye. I'll see you on this side soon.
I heard footsteps coming from behind me in time to duck and force the creature to take the bullet from Locke's gun and attack Locke. The creature decapitated Locke with one swing of its arm and opened his stomach with another. Unfortunately, Locke's insides were nothing more than sand. Standing there before me was the beast that had killed Aisha and Balan. Fully erect, the werehyena stood a good 6 feet. It stared at me with hungry eyes and parted jaws that revealed razor-sharp fangs filled with saliva.
What is this?
It snarled.
A human stuffed with sand!
The werehyena sniffed the air.
But you have blood coursing through your veins.
In my hand, I had a thin chain called Glipnir, designed after the binding thread that held down Fenrir, the mighty wolf of Norse mythology. I threw it at the werehyena. Glipnir immediately went to work, wrapping itself all around the creature and forcing it onto the ground. The werehyena laughed.
This won't hold me forever,
it said, chewing the chain.
Your flesh is mine.
Without a second thought, I ran back to the Forerunner and started for Duel Faran. You see, dear listener, the werehyena wasn't lying. Glipnir wouldn't be able to hold it down forever. The creature would use its powerful jaws to break through the chain within a few minutes. And since I wasn't equipped to take on a beast of this sort, my best bet was to go back to the village and get as many villagers out of there as possible. Then I could rendezvous with the local intelligencer and acquire the right gear for the situation. As for the werehyena itself, well, that was a violent beast. Unlike its European counterpart, the werewolf, the werehyena is not a human. It is a hyena with the ability to shapeshift into a human form. And the one terrorizing Duel Faran was endowed with the additional ability to control others, in this case, the boys from the school. According to Lyle's records, a werehyena uses pheromones that teenagers are susceptible to. Others use a more potent method, via semen. That's how this one was able to turn those boys into vicious killers. In essence, those boys were under the werehyena's control. I was still a few miles out from the village when my mind's eye painted the picture of what was happening in Duel Faran. Aisha Ali, the schoolteacher, was in need of help at the school. Her class sizes were starting to increase, which was great news, but she alone couldn't handle the influx of children. So, she was grateful when Farah appeared as if from nowhere to help educate the youth. For several weeks, nothing was out of the ordinary. Aisha was thrilled that the school was becoming a success, but it wouldn't have been long before Aisha started to notice the odd things happening around her. It would have started with the students of the school turning on each other through fighting, pranks, and obscene gestures. Then the laughter, the obnoxious and consistent laughter interspersed with those obscene gestures. Aisha found herself dealing with discipline more than education. And it was exhausting because the children weren't listening to her.
Everything was a joke. When she spoke with Farah and asked what they could do to help the children understand and take their education seriously, Farah shrugged her shoulders and said what could they do? If the children didn't want to listen, then they didn't want to listen. There was nothing that could be done. Aisha, however, was not one to give up on her students. Like a true teacher, Aisha tried different strategies to reach them, but with everything she tried, the further the students seemed. It wasn't long before their adolescent behavior evolved into dangerous and violent intent. The children were disappearing. Aisha found handwritten letters from these students stating that their parents packed up and left for the city. No warning, no goodbyes, nothing. Soon, Aisha realized that the only students who remained at the school were the most rambunctious and violent. What happened next, dear listener, is purely speculation on my part. One night, Aisha, working late at the school, caught wind of an awful stench emanating from one of the classrooms. Concerned, Aisha made her way into the room in question and followed her nose to the back closet. Slowly, she opened the door to find it empty save a tunnel that had been dug by crushing the wooden floorboards and disturbing the earth. A powerful whiff of the pungent odor assaulted her nose once again. She ran back to the hallway, took a deep breath, and made her way into the tunnel. It didn't take long for her to come across a small opening that gave way to a shallow cave-like structure. Here, in semi-darkness, Aisha found the remains of the missing children, or rather, what parts of them remained. Then she heard the laughter of one of the children. Fearing that they were trapped, Aisha ran toward the laughter. But the laughing child wasn't trapped. No, the child was having himself a feast, ripping into and biting off pieces of flesh from one of his former classmates. The child was so engrossed in his meal that he didn't notice Aisha, giving her enough time to crawl out of that hole and leave the school. Fear pressed its talons on Aisha as she tried to maintain her composure in front of the boys who were looking at her with those hungry eyes. The boys she once knew. The boys she no longer recognized. Unfortunately, for Aisha, those boys would be the last thing she'd ever see. I was too late by the time I made it back to Dhul Faran. The grounds of the village were filled with the chewed up corpses of the villagers. The sands were incarnadine, flowing thick maroon pools that echoed Sikmet's unquenchable bloodlust. There would be no intelligencers able to help me this time around, especially now that I was trapped. I had to give the Werehyena credit. It made me think that I could gain the upper hand by helping the villagers and obtaining the right gear to stop it. Instead, all it did was send me running right into its lair. The only gear I had on me were my wits, and I would have to use them if I was going to have a chance of walking out of this alive. I used the flashlight I found in the Forerunner's glove box and followed the trails of blood all the way back to the school. In the thick of night, the school building looked and felt different somehow. The structure of the place seemed hazy, almost as if the school itself was a mirage. I followed the blood into the school. There was a long hallway that seemed to stretch forever. I pointed my light ahead and could see a figure moving toward me. It hobbled from side to side for a moment before the flashlight caught it. "Well?" Victoria said. "Is that you? Where are we?" I pushed past the illusion of Victoria, for that is what she was. It made sense now. The haze that seemed to come off of the school's walls was nothing more than an enchantment. Somehow, the interior of the school had defied the laws of earthly physics and expanded its size compared to its outside limitations. "Well, what's wrong?" Victoria said. "Why won't you talk to me?" The endless hall finally gave way to an intersection where a large shadow ran past at blinding speed. I backed up against the wall and waited for a moment. When I didn't hear anything, I peered into the intersection and saw nothing but another long hallway. "I'm scared, Will." Victoria wrapped her arm around mine. "Please, hold me."
"Get thee gone, darkness," I said, pushing the effigy off me.
"Well,"
don't understand. Why would you treat me like this?
I shone the flashlight on the effigy. The image of Victoria as a human puppet filled with sand took me aback. This version of Victoria was reminiscent of Agent Locke, except this one lacked the detail that Locke had. It made sense. Locke had actually been killed and turned into a wax figure, but this copy of Victoria was just that, a copy. And I was relieved to see that I was right. Just below her neck was the birthmark that looked like a fox's tail. It was this birthmark, one that Victoria does not have, that gave it away. All Lyle's agents are trained to incorporate false identifying markers on all those we know in our memories of them. If the situation ever came that a copy of that person was made, which was usually made from our memories of that person, a false identifying marker would confirm that that person or thing that we were looking at was nothing more than just an illusion. The effigy stared at me with its blue marbles for eyes, its face sagging. "Why won't you believe it's me?" it said. "I'm real. I'm alive. I'm your Victoria." "Victoria doesn't belong to me," I said. "She belongs to herself." The effigy shrieked and lunged itself at me. I crouched just before it could touch me and used its momentum to throw it out into the intersection where the shadow grabbed it and ripped it to shreds. Sand spilled everywhere. Standing there in the shadows was the werehyena. It laughed and growled at the same time. "You will die here tonight." "That works both ways," I said. The werehyena sprang toward me and pinned me up against the wall. It tried to snap its jaws, but found that there was a flashlight jammed into its mouth. I was able to shove the light into its mouth a second before it tried to bite my head off. Luckily, the flashlight was made of metal that would keep the werehyena busy for a moment, enough for me to slip free of its grip. I jumped into the intersection and ran down this endless hall until I reached a classroom. Inside, I looked around for anything I could use to slay the werehyena. When it came to this beast, there was no reasoning with it. Therefore, I needed to figure something out fast if I was going to stop it from repeating its slaughter on another village or town. It didn't take me long to figure out that I was in Ferris's classroom, or rather, her den. Slathered all over the walls were pieces of human flesh. The stench that lingered here was nauseating, and the floor was littered with bones and rotting limbs of humans, students. I glanced around the room and found several flipped over chairs and desks. Without wasting a moment, I ran over to a desk and kicked free one of its wooden legs, making sure that I tore the wooden piece off roughly so that it was sharp at its end. The werehyena barged into the room, its mix of laughter and growl shattering the silence.
"Stop fighting and running," it said. "I'm going to eat you just like I did everyone else here."
"It was you Aisha saw that night, wasn't it, Farah?" Farah laughed.
"Sure, you can call me that. It's just a human name. We hyenas prefer no names. We are one." "And Aisha walked in on me eating one of her top students."
Farah chuckled.
"The stupid kid was still alive as I gorged its insides. Despite his stomach wide open with my snout feasting, the kid still stuck his arm out and cried, 'Help!' when he saw Aisha."
Farah licked her snout.
"The dumb bitch ran out of here. But too bad for her. My followers were ready to feast on her. They did well by eating her alive the hyena way."
That was a fact, dear listener. Hyenas are known to eat their prey while it's still alive. Hyenas are brutal and violent creatures. "Where are your followers?" I said, while tightening my grip on the desk leg.
"In me," Ferris said. "They failed to kill you, so all they had to go. Don't worry, though. They tasted delicious. Oh, nothing is more tasty than human flesh. It's so good."
Farah lunged at me from across the room at lightning speed. I knew I wouldn't be strong enough to overpower the werehyena. Therefore, I gripped the dusty leg and placed it in front of my abdomen the moment Ferris' snout was inches from tearing me open. I drove the wooden stake deep into her throat until it pierced itself outward from the back. Farrah laughed, followed by howling in pain. She backed off, trying to pull the stake out of her mouth, and achieved it. She vomited blood. In a hoarse voice, she said,
"Slain or phallic device,"
she chuckled.
"Should have been mine."
The werehyena dropped to its knees. It stared at me for a moment with its dark eyes and bloody mouth before it hit the ground, lifeless. In the weeks that followed the incidents at Dol Faran, Laios sent a team of intelligencers to clean up the village. All villagers, including the slain teenage boys who were under the control of the werehyena, were collected and given proper funerals. As of this report, the town of Dol Faran can no longer be found on any world map because, like many other towns and villages Laios has dealt with in such manners, it no longer exists. The werehyena, like many hyenas, was equipped with a pseudo-penis despite it being of the female persuasion. The teenage boys who were under the control of the werehyena, it was discovered, had been sodomized by it, which is what turned them into her followers. In essence, the werehyena injected them with a potent mind control substance that ran through their veins. A further analysis of the surrounding area of Somaliland revealed that this werehyena had been terrorizing other rural villages. It seemed as if this werehyena did not want to be noticed by many, probably so that it could continue to feast on human flesh untroubled. And since the majority of the world does not turn an eye to those living out in rural lands, the werehyena was able to get its fill of humans. For how long, however, is still to be determined, but the general consensus puts the werehyena's kills in the hundreds. Agent Locke, the original Laios agent assigned to this mission, met his demise at the hands of Tamamo no Me while investigating the ruins. She made short work of him, which says a lot about this yokai's strength, for Agent Locke was a strong and capable agent. Once she dispatched him from this world into the unknown country, she used a spell to reanimate his body by using sand and turned him into her wax puppet. This agent believes this to be a deliberate and threatening message to Laios. Not only has Tamamo no Me killed intelligencers, but she's now killed field agents without breaking a sweat. And to add injury to insult, she bewitched the school in Dol Faran to demonstrate her power and how she could interfere whenever it pleased her. What Agent Locke said about Tamamo no Me being then, here, there, and what Nignevin said about her ruling man's globe has forced this agent to conclude that Tamamo no Me has somehow gained the ability to be in the past, present, and future simultaneously. To what ends, this agent still does not know. However, something must be done about this before she gains more power. The fact that so many have been thinking about her, including the director of Laios, Patrice Landless, leads this agent to believe that Tamamo no Me needs people to constantly think of her in order for her power to increase. Like a goddess of any mythology, she needs praise and prayers to exist and grow strong. But how she's doing this exactly, this agent still does not know. Of course, for the moment, all of this is just a hypothesis. Further investigation is required. The French poet and philosopher Paul Valéry once said, "One can say that all we know, that is, all we have the power to do, has finally turned against what we are." Humanity has come so far in the brief time span of the small blue planet, but when viewed through a larger lens, humanity has not achieved much in maturation. Or if humanity has matured, it has only gone so far as to reach adolescence. Like Valéry said, all of the knowledge humanity has gained has been used to create power, i.e. weapons of mass destruction, technologies used to harm one another, and artificial intelligence. But all this newly gained power, it's possible, has turned against what it means to be human. For decades, writers and philosophers have strived so hard to understand what it means to be human, to understand the heart and soul. William Shakespeare wrote about the human condition and the psychology behind the human to ask what it is that makes humans tick. Immanuel Kant spent his life understanding morality so that he could better humanity. Mary Shelley wanted to know what it was about power that inebriated mankind and how that power could backfire on man. Despite the Herculean effort, these writers and philosophers, these are just a few of countless others that have tried, humanity is still found wanting. Whatever it is that being human means, one thing is clear. Humanity and the animal kingdom are not so different. Hannah Arendt, in her book On Violence, said that man is not unlike animals. Many believe that animals act like humans at certain times, or that animals sometimes display human-like qualities. But if it was the other way around, like Arendt believed, that would be interesting. The humans are like animals. Regardless of viewpoints, humans are animals within the animal kingdom. Humans are not excluded. Within this kingdom, humans are the apex predators. And like any predator, violence and power is demonstrated. In the case of the werehyena, it could be seen as a monster. This agent believes it was. But in the end, the werehyena was doing what it was programmed to do by nature. Hyenas by nature are violent and powerful beings. They're relentless, aggressive, and vicious. The same thing can be said about humans. While one can look at a pack of hyenas eating their prey alive, call these creatures monsters, one can see a human who kills or tortures or even eats their victims alive as the same thing, monsters. Many humans want power that leads to corruption, that leads to violence. This agent fears that the insatiable craving for power will ultimately continue to lead humanity into a world further tainted by corruption and violence. And what will be the outcome? Tamamo no Mae? No, she's just a yokai who's hellbent on the same sauce as the rest of the beings living in this blue marble. The outcome, this agent wonders, will be the undeniable extinction of all beings on this planet. How? That's anybody's guess. It could be Tamamo no Mae, it could be AI, it could be war ad nauseam. And the apex predator of this world will have no one to blame but itself.